Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Hi, everybody, from Wondery. Welcome to another episode of Tides of History, actually the 100th episode of our prehistory season. I'm Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me. At first glance, the Andes Mountains and the dry shorelines of the Pacific nearby don't look like the most obvious place for some of the oldest complex societies in the world to emerge. Yet, more than 5,000 years ago, that's exactly what happened. And over the succeeding millennia, the Andes have been home to a wide variety of sophisticated cultures and states. We're most familiar with the Inca Empire, but that was only the latest of a long sequence dating back thousands of years. Today's guest is going to help us get a handle on the beginnings of this sequence, especially what are known as the initial period and the early horizon. Jason Nesbitt is an associate professor of anthropology at Tulane University, and he is a specialist on the archaeology of the Andes in these periods. His work covers a variety of topics, including the emergence of complex societies, stable isotope analysis, and the interactions between people, culture, and their environments. It's really cool stuff, and the implications will make you think hard about the present as well as the past. Professor Nesbitt, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Patrick. It's great to be here. Big fan.
Well, so what drew you to studying the Andes in the first place? I mean, why archaeology? Why the initial period and the early horizon?
Yeah, well, I started in archaeology and actually in Canada. I'm originally from Canada, a small town in Ontario, and was interested in archaeology from a very early age. And I went and did my undergraduate at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver. And while I was there, I worked mainly on Canadian archaeology, specifically the British Columbia coast, and became really interested in maritime adaptations of coastal foragers and early complexity and topics like that. And as I was doing more and more advanced research there, I got interested in more comparative kinds of studies. And one of my professors recommended a work by Michael Mosley called The Maritime Foundations of Andean Civilization, which argued, it's dated in some ways, but was looking at early monumentality on the Pacific coast and how it could have been supported by a largely maritime-based economy. And so I kept reading more and more about ancient Peru, and I got very interested and then went to Trent University for a master's degree. And I joined a project directed by John Topic and Teresa Topic and a Peruvian archaeologist named Alfredo Melli on a project called the Catakil Project, which took place in the northern highlands of Peru and was looking at an oracle that was widely known during the Inca Empire. And so my master's thesis was actually a study of mountain worship during the period just before the Incas and during Inca time, so between basically the 12th century or 13th century AD until the early 1600s. And that was way back in the early 2000s. And then I went back on that same project, but had much more time to explore Peru. And as I was doing my graduate work, I was reading much more about ancient Peru and was interested in sort of the development of complexity, sort of as you were getting at in your introduction of what came before the Incas. And so during 2003, I had a lot more time as I was working on this project to actually travel around Peru. And I went to Norte Chico, where there are some of these early third millennium BC monuments. Corral is maybe the most well-known one to the public anyway. And then the Casma Valley, which had these sort of a wonderland of initial period or late or early second millennium BC monuments. And I got very interested in that topic and then did my graduate work at Yale University and explored a lot of different possibilities, but eventually settled on a topic looking at an archaeological site called Caballo Muerto. And basically, the initial period is about 1800 BC to 800 or 900 BC. And so I did my project on this site and sort of went from there. And now I do archaeological work also in Highland Peru and a little bit in the sort of fringes of the upper Amazon. So that's how I basically got into Andean archaeology. And so most of my research since then has been on these questions of early complexity and sort of this time period between the third millennium and first millennium BC.
So A lot of your work over the years has focused on how people interact with the changing environments in which they live. So the environment not as a given, but as a kind of a changing set of parameters. And one of the things I really like about the way that you approach this in your work is that it's sophisticated. There's not this oversimplified idea where people are prisoners of their environments. So you place a lot of emphasis on human agency, the ability to recover from disasters. How can archaeology tell us about these things?
Well, maybe just to step back just a little bit, it's worth just pointing out that the Andean environment itself is one of real contrasts, where you have a desert coastline, the desert Pacific coastline, where a lot of these early monuments first occur. Then you have the highland regions of the Andes, so the Andes Mountains, basically, which also have contemporary kinds of complex developments, but much higher elevations. And then as you go further to the east, you start to drop down into the eastern slopes of the Andes and into the tropical forest region. Basically, for our purposes here, the upper reaches of the Amazon basin or the western Amazon. So you have a sort of area of environmental contrasts. And these areas seem to have, in some ways, parallel developments throughout the time periods we're talking about today, in other ways, different ones. But that there are these kinds of three environmental extremes. On the Peruvian coast, where I did my first sort of work on the initial period, it's an interesting area because you have this desert coast that's then bisected or sort of has a series of coastal river valleys which run down from the Andes Mountains that sort of form the basis for farming systems that develop at least by 2500 BC, where they become more intensified.
Yeah, so you have extreme environmental contrast, and it's also a pretty sensitive environment because of the aridity of the coastline, because of the potential for disruption to the current offshore, the effect of changes in precipitation on the highlands. It's one where human responses to the environment should be fairly visible in the archaeological record. Is that fair to say?
Yes, definitely fair to say. So on the Pacific coast, you have really one of the, as I said, kind of in the introduction, this very rich shoreline. That's dictated by some of the cold Peruvian coast. Then you have these river systems that flow down from the Andes that are also sensitive to precipitation happening in the highlands. And then I think, as you were alluding to, you also have these moments of sort of punctuated or sporadic and sudden changes in the climate, particularly on the Peruvian coast, from the El Nino phenomena, which I've worked a little bit on over the years, in which there are changes in those currents on the coast, where the Pacific coast ocean temperatures rise, that creates cloud formations and storms that move their way towards the east. And sort of once they meet the sort of foothills of the Andes, drop all of this precipitation down, which is essentially causes torrential flooding on an otherwise normally desert coast that causes these kinds of sporadic changes that we refer to as the El Nino phenomenon.
Normally, you would think if you've got a pretty arid environment, rain would be, large amounts of precipitation would be a good thing. But if you have an environment that is that arid, that's going to cause really devastating consequences, right? Especially landslides, you mentioned flooding. Like if you've got kind of a human created environment that's poised in a very specific ecological niche, when you disrupt that niche, people have to respond.
Right. So the El Nino phenomena causes sort of two big problems, right? One is on the sea surface temperature changes. The temperature goes up significantly as the waters become warmer in temperature. This changes the composition of fisheries, for one. But then there, as you point out, there's this terrestrial effect from the flooding. Now, if you imagine the Peruvian coast, it's a very much a desert that's broken up by these river systems. But otherwise, it's relatively devoid of vegetation. And what you have is that those river systems I mentioned can flood. But then there are all these dry gullies that we refer to as quebradas, which are filled with unconsolidated kinds of sediment. When these floods happen, all of that sediment also rushes down. Now, the people, say, of the late third and second millennium BC are practicing irrigation agriculture by that time. And so those kinds of debris flows certainly would have disrupted or blocked or destroyed canals and other kinds of irrigation or other kinds of agricultural infrastructure. As I think we'll probably get into, the peoples of this time were building very large monuments, which were also often in the paths of these kinds of destructive quebradas. Actually, my colleague, one of my graduate students, Rachel Johnson, and I recently presented something in Chicago that seems to indicate that ancient peoples intentionally placed their monuments in some of these hazardous locations, which speaks to a different way of thinking about these kinds of environments as well. So there's all kinds of natural disruptions that then create disruptions in their cultural, religious, and economic systems.
Yeah, so, okay, well, that's really interesting. And that gets at, one of the things that I mentioned earlier that I really like about your work is you're talking about a complex set of interactions between people, their subsistence systems, their religious and cultural patterns of behavior and belief, and the environment around them. So it's not just the environment changes and things fall apart, or the environment changes and people have to do X. People have a whole array of different ways in which they can respond when an El Nino event happens.
Yeah, there are a number of different responses that people take. And just as a couple of examples, so for the initial period, so right at the beginning of the second millennium BC, most of these coastal valleys are filled with multiple temples. They're sort of large, if you want to think about, for the audience to think about, sort of step pyramid or step platform buildings with large plazas. And they're found basically from Lima all the way to the north coast of Peru, all in these coastal valleys. Most of them are in zones that are susceptible to El Nino. And during my research at Caballo Muerto as part of my dissertation, we excavated one of these in which we found environmental proxies for multiple flooding events that affected this temple. And what we found was that they didn't abandon it or anything like that. They just kind of rebuilt the structure over and over these. As these flood events happened, once they ended, they built another structure over top of it. And these temples continued to thrive. And one of the things that I concluded in an article that was published a few years ago was that when we think about the response to El Nino, it can't just be in sort of economic terms, that there's a religious dimension. And if you think about many religions around the world, and if we want to think about this in terms of ancient religions, many of them are oriented. Some of the deities have to do with weather. A lot of elements of being a successful priest or some kind of religious specialist is predicting weather, thinking about the natural environment, ecology, because of agricultural production and things like that, but for other reasons as well. And so they were building these temples over and over again. And so there was a kind of, if you want to think about it, a kind of religious response. It turns out that when I started to do more comparative work, that there are other temples from other parts of Peru at this time did other kinds of responses. So, for example, Richard Berger and Lucy Salazar, who worked on sites of the same age near Lima, they found at a site called Manchay Bajo that the inhabitants built a giant wall around the site to sort of block off these debris flows from El Nino. So they invested all of this energy. They put a site that the ancient builders would have 100% knew this was a dangerous place to put it. And they intentionally did it, but they also constructed infrastructure to mitigate against those disasters. So that's one kind of response. So this wall blocked off this quebrada. At an economic level, my colleague Ari Caramanica at Vanderbilt recently published a very interesting study that looked at other kinds of agricultural infrastructure. Rather than just canals, that there are other kinds of systems that they created, different kinds of gardening systems and so on, that would channel waters in a different way. So if the canals were destroyed, they would put in this other system. So El Nino, we think of El Nino today as this kind of unpredictable disaster. And it seems that in the past, the indigenous inhabitants of coastal Peru for millennia had sort of factored this in to their belief systems, into their settlement systems, into their economic systems, and had devised all kinds of ingenious ways of managing it. Even if they couldn't predict exactly when they happened, they had these systems that would allow them to mitigate them, to mitigate these kinds of flood events. So there's a series of really intriguing studies out there.
Yeah, this was something in your work. Yet you had a really, I thought, an elegant way of summing that up. You said that they regarded El Nino as part of the socio-ecological norm, that rather than building their entire cultural and subsistence system around a static environment, it was built around the idea that there were going to be challenges, there were things that were going to happen, and they were going to have to deal with that if this was the place where they wanted to live.
Right. So there's a movement in Andean archaeology, sometimes referred to as the ontological turn. This is a big factor and a big topic in archaeology, but in a sense, it's just looking at what are the sort of philosophies and worldviews of other people? And it's very clear that, say, the indigenous inhabitants of coastal Peru had a very different view of the environment, where this was part of it's not necessarily predictable, but it's something they know is going to happen. It's factored into the cycle. They have all kinds of belief systems. As an aside, much later in time, there's evidence that during certain El Niños, for the Moche culture and Chimú cultures, that people seemed to practice some human sacrifice during some of these events. There's even some historical documentation from the Spaniards that seems to back this up. So there's a lot of different ways that people thought of these, not just as a disaster in the way we think of a disaster, but also some kind of cosmological event in a sense. And I think archaeologists need to take that part of it seriously.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know, after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used, because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/wondery. rocketmoney.com/wondery.
I want to follow up on that, because something that grows naturally out of this is the concept of collapse, that we have these environmental events and at some point people just can't respond anymore to them and you know, society falls apart. You collaborated on a really big, really interesting article about the concept of collapse. I mean, so how have people talked about collapse? Do you think it's viable? If we can't use collapse, what should we be using instead?
Well, okay, so that paper, you might find this interesting as a historian. That paper on collapse grew out of a collaboration with something called the Climate Change and History Research Initiative at Princeton University, which was led by a historian, a very famous, really great historian, John Halden. And he had, as I understand it, over time had become increasingly interested in sort of the collaboration of historians, archaeologists, climate scientists, so geologists and other people that work on paleoenvironment. And he brought them all together for this conference. And this was the sort of, this paper was one of the outcomes. So I talked about El Nino, but people talked about the basin of Mexico. People talked about Byzantine things and so on. It was a very interesting conference. And then we, over time, put together this paper at looking at collapse, which is its own kind of complex term, right? You've done the podcast on Fall of Rome, right? And so there's been all these different views about how the Roman Empire collapsed. And likewise, in Peru, there's been a lot of interest, and in the Americas in general, on the relationship between climate and culture change. And of course, that's a huge challenge, right? So first, maybe what we mean by collapse is something happens and the society somehow changes, quote unquote, negatively, right? So if monument building is a huge thing, they stop doing monument building. The centralized political system might become decentralized. An urban center becomes abandoned or something like that. And there's been this long trajectory of using some kind of environmental factors. We often refer to this as environmental determinism, right? So in the Andes, people have often invoked El Nino as a kind of reason for some kinds of political collapse. But it turns out that the picture is much more complicated than that. At a sort of technical level, like at an archaeological level, we have a kind of problem of what Dan Sandweiss and Jeffrey Quilter referred to as the sort of challenge of going from collation, right, the identification of proxies for or indicators of environmental change, to correlation, that is, linking those environmental changes somehow directly with the archaeological record, which is often very hard, and then causation, that okay, then we can go to that third C causation of, okay, was this somehow causal? And in most cases, in my view, when you try to connect them, it never quite works that way. So for example, the example from Caballo Muerto, we have the sort of El Nino event right with the archaeological event of monument building, or at Manchay Bajo, same kinds of things. Where we see these, it doesn't seem to line up in any way. So this gets to this other challenge of really what is collapse. In my feeling, I mean, I co-authored this paper, I believe it's a kind of real phenomenon, but it has to be explained in a sort of myriad of ways, that there's all kinds of social, political, potentially environmental factors that go into sort of social transformation. So this has been well illustrated in your podcast on Fall of Rome, but I think you're familiar with the work of Eric Klein, who looked at the end of the Bronze Age, where he looked at a whole range of factors, from warfare to failing trade networks, earthquakes, a sort of whole series of events that happened over a long span of time. So there's also a temporal dimension. Often the narrative of collapse is a very quick one, but it turns out that these things take place over centuries. My own view, we were talking before the podcast about the Dawn of Everything book, this book coming out. I also think we want to think more about political factors, that there are internal kinds of potentially discontent and things like that, that people try to overturn one regime with another one. So if it's a highly centralized, overly hierarchical one, and then you see afterwards a more decentralized, maybe more egalitarian system, you may be seeing the answer right there, that there's some kind of political movement to change things. Now, that's not to say the environment doesn't play a factor. It clearly has to, right? People have to eat, they have to settle in certain places and so on. But it's much more complicated. And I think for the most part, archaeologists over the last several decades have sort of reoriented their way from thinking of humans as passive sort of respondents to environmental change to very active. We make all kinds of choices. So building different kinds of canal systems, or constructing new kinds of infrastructure, or having flexible, resilient political systems or farming systems. Those kinds of things are how we should be looking at the environment. And then also, as we were talking about, their own perception of the environment is a very large factor as well. It's been long known that what we refer to as a disaster is really very much the human component. It's not so much a hurricane. You know, I live in New Orleans, and a hurricane can happen. The hurricane can be a real disaster, not just because of the actual environmental event, but also problems of infrastructure, problems of inequality in the city, housing issues, infrastructural government, all kinds of things can contribute to what we think of as a disaster, not just the actual environmental event.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think New Orleans is a really interesting example of that, right? Like the hurricane isn't so much the problem, it's the response to the hurricane. If you live in New Orleans, you know that hurricanes are going to happen, and maybe the frequency of them changes as climatic factors take hold. But if you rebuild the things that get broken, and you build better dikes, and you build better water management infrastructure in general, and you know, you're prepared for the next one, that would be a sign of what we would call resilience, right? That you've got a series of flexible and resilient systems that are designed to accommodate the shifts in the environment. But if you have a really fragile set of surrounding systems, if you have an inflexible pattern of subsistence, if you have an inflexible settlement pattern, an overly extractive, centralized political system, then that's going to dramatically affect the way in which your society can respond to those challenges as they happen.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I mean, one lesson that we've learned is this sort of difference between sort of top-down kinds of political organization versus more bottom-up kinds of organization. So the study I mentioned of farming systems that was done by my colleague Ari Karamanika, one of her central arguments is that a lot of the canal systems themselves, these really large canals, may have been more managed. But there were these other systems that seemed to have been based on sort of local scientific knowledge of farmers. And that was sort of a bottom-up approach that they used to sort of buffer these kinds of environmental disasters. I've long argued that initial period societies and late pre-ceramic one are more cooperative. They don't seem to be overly hierarchical. And that may be part of it too, that if a canal gets destroyed, that people quickly respond cooperatively by redigging these kinds of gravity canals and getting them operating very quickly. So there's a lot of, when we look at this, we often look too much at the environmental dimension. And rightfully so, that's important. But we also want to look at what's the human dimension? What are the sort of social and religious, but social responses that we can study archaeologically? And those are also available to us by looking at other kinds of agricultural systems or other kinds of works that people construct.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I've got so many things buzzing through my head as we're talking about this. I grew up in a place where agriculture was a really big deal, but especially commercial agriculture. And one of the big cash crops in central Washington is cherries, which are extremely sensitive to environmental fluctuations. Now, that's a problem for the cherry farmers because they're growing a commercial crop for worldwide export. That fluctuation in temperatures is not a disaster because of the fluctuation in temperatures. It's a disaster because of the way in which their crop fits into global systems of agricultural export. So that's a very specific kind of disaster that's a product of a much larger set of interconnected systems, not just the temperature happens to be off by a degree or two.
Right. And of course, I think that illustrates the point really well that so you have these relatively minor fluctuations, which aren't disastrous on their own right. But once you've invested the cultural and socioeconomic choice of investing in cherry trees, you've made a choice. And then when that goes bad, you've made a choice that then sort of has all these kinds of ripple effects, both to the local economy and then to the world economy that relies on obtaining these things and so on. So I think that illustrates the point really well. So the disaster isn't, if you're growing something else, it wouldn't necessarily be affected by that kind of change. But once you've invested in a certain kind of crop.
And that goes ideologically too, right? If you have, let's say, a political religious class whose legitimacy is based on their claims to control the weather or to prevent bad harvests or to prevent El Nino, if that happens, then it's a much more serious disaster for that ruling elite than it would be otherwise.
Yeah. And I mean, there are some historical documents from much later in time. So there's a paper about the Chimú from the 1940s that sort of looks at historical narratives about Chimú peoples and refers to an elite being basically killed because of a El Nino event. And so there are other stories from that time period about sort of the relationship of El Nino and ruling classes and things like that. So those things exist. The further back in time, it's a little harder to do. One thing I should have said maybe is a lot of these temples that we look at the initial period and last for a really long time. Some of them seem to have been 4 or 5 centuries, some maybe even a bit longer, some shorter. But multiples, or, you know, many, 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 many human generations of occupation and reutilization of these places. So this seems to be a system at that time period that endured for a very long, long period of time.
So I want to follow up on that. When you have places like that, that are persistent in the landscape, that form kind of the bedrock of, you know, kind of your society's spatial understanding of the world. What do you think that tells you about that society, about what it values and about how it works? I mean, a big question, but...
No, it's a really interesting question. So when we look at the initial period and even times before it, what we see is most coastal valleys have numerous what we call ceremonial centers. So these temple constructions I mentioned, these platformed buildings, and they last from, you know, for the initial period from 1700 or 1800 BC till 1000, some cases a little later. It's a very long tradition. Many of these monuments, if you follow this up, are some of the largest in Peru for any time period. So for example, there's a building called Seichin Alto, which I think is 45 or 50 meters in height. So very, very big buildings. And a lot of these structures also seem to have been built over time. So they sort of grow in height over time. People cyclically rebuild them. And there's some good documentation of that from lots of different sites from different parts of coastal Peru. These places would have been very visible on the landscape. There's some indicators that they're looking sort of towards the Andes Mountains. So maybe looking to the source waters of their agricultural systems is an old idea, but I think one that has some value. Many of these places were adorned with different traditions of mural art. So there are a number of famous sites, Cardal and the Central Coast, or La Galgada. There are a bunch of places. There's some sites in Mojeque and Casma. There are a bunch of Huacalos Reyes at Caballo Muerto. There's a bunch of them that are adorned with religious iconography. So they would have been outwardly visually impressive, not just in terms of height, but also art that people wouldn't see on a daily basis necessarily. They have large plazas. that were meant for large groupings of people. But they also had on their summits and other parts of them architecture that was more restricted. And there are different views on this. My own view and other archaeologists is that these were spaces for religious specialists that had more access to some kinds of esoteric knowledge. There may have been hierarchies of priests or religious specialists. And so people with more esoteric knowledge had sort of access to certain kinds of buildings. So they were temples. So they would have been sort of persistent places on a landscape that maybe during El Nino events was quite dynamic. I should add that, seeing as we've talked a lot about El Nino. There are evidence from a number of sites that people lived, that they also had sort of small-scale village or hamlet settlements settled around them. But we know very little about the sort of quote-unquote everyday kinds of settlements within these valleys. We know a lot more about these very visible monuments because they are so enduring. So they would have been places, though, that people would have gathered at, I think, quite often. We were talking before the beginning of this show that I think that it's telling us something, that they've invested so much energy in them. They're so large, and there's so many of them. I think people are spending an awfully lot of time in some kinds of ceremonial practices, which is different from later societies in the same region.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/youknowbusiness.
Something that comes through very clearly that I think listeners may not know is the sheer density of these places, which you alluded to, that often one is visible from the next in these regions, that they're much thicker on the ground. It's not like you have one big capital city that has a ton of monumental architecture. They're scattered all over the landscape.
Yes. So just to maybe give the listeners a sense, basically from Lima to the north coast of Peru, there are a bunch of these coastal valleys. All of them have multiple centers. And the ones that have been well investigated, we know some of them have 10 or 12 of these very large temples. My PhD advisor and colleague and friend, Richard Berger, wrote a paper I think is really instructive called Centro de Qué, meaning center of what? Right, where he was talking about this kind of settlement pattern, that we refer to them as ceremonial centers, but there's actually many of them. So you can't really refer to a single political center. And we're not even sure how people really related to them. One idea that's prevalent, that's a possibility, is that each one of those monuments corresponded to some kind of small-scale polity. That's one possibility. Another one is that people sort of, that these were temples that inhabitants of the valley sort of visited at different times of the year and sort of cycled around them, you know, those that were contemporary anyways, where they may go between different temples. A colleague of mine, Tom Zobeck, used an analogy of the Balinese water temples that managed rice agricultural systems in Southeast Asia, where there are multiple temples that have sort of different relationships with the agricultural cycle and so on. And he argued that maybe that's what we're seeing in the initial period. So there are a lot of possibilities. But one thing is very clear is that the settlement system is very, very different from later time periods. And I include myself in this. I don't think archaeologists specializing at this time have taken this seriously enough. And we should think much more about that pattern.
Well, it's really easy if you're looking at these monuments to immediately place them into a global comparative framework and say, well, you have monumental buildings. These obviously must correspond to some sort of settlement hierarchy, which in turn must obviously correspond to some sort of nascent state system, right? But that's an imposition based on that framework, not necessarily a reflection of what the people themselves thought they were doing.
Right. So if you go back, you know, like just thinking about, say, the work of Gordon Child, who was this pioneering archaeologist, wrote this famous paper, The Urban Revolution, which wasn't so much necessarily just about urbanism, but defining civilization, right? And he sort of listed a series of criteria, and he was relying mainly on the Near East and Eurasia. And he created this list of 10 traits that sort of constitute sort of hierarchical civilization societies, right?
one of his criteria was monuments. And the idea was, well, monuments require a centralized political authority to coordinate the labor. That view, while it still holds, has sort of eroded away over the years based on discoveries in Peru, that a lot of these sites, in my view, not everyone, I should point out that this is one view of many, but one view is the evidence that we have does not show a lot of evidence for individualized social inequality. So we don't have burials that stand apart, or many that stand apart. We don't really have evidence for elite classes. And then with the monuments themselves, they seem to have been built gradually, which may have required smaller numbers of people and so on. Now, this isn't to say, and I want to make this very clear, that there was no planning behind these. These monuments required a tremendous amount of engineering and scientific knowledge. Lots of them are, you know, perfectly rectangular. They have orientations. They had a system of measurements. There's all kinds of engineering techniques within the construction for retaining fill and things like that. So there's a lot of scientific knowledge that goes into the construction of these. But they don't seem to be built by sort of like a centralized political authority. They weren't meant for necessarily for the aggrandizement of a single person. If people think of, say, pyramids in Egypt or something, where they, you know, basically to bury one person or a small cadre of people. This is very different. And this kind of idea has sort of eroded away by a number of discoveries. So Peru is one place. The discoveries of monuments in Neolithic Near East, I think there's a lot to learn from those that also seem to be constructions of early, so Göbekli Tepe and places like that, of construction of early ceremonial architecture, in which there may be hierarchies, but they seem to last for short amounts of time and then sort of disperse. We have places like closer to where I live, Poverty Point, also seems to have been built by societies that don't fit kinds of the typical models we think of in sort of neo-evolutionary perspectives. Now in Mesoamerica, we have all the work by Takeshi Inomada and other people looking at monuments contemporary with the Olmecs and the Maya region that also seem to be built by societies that don't fit these kinds of typical models of centralized hierarchical societies. They seem to be something different that we don't really have great ethnographic or contemporary kinds of analogies that we can draw on. They seem to be societies that are organized on principles that we have trouble drawing out from the models that we currently have.
It's one of the real problems with assuming that everything is in the ethnographic record. As useful as the ethnographic record is and can be for a whole bunch of different reasons, people have been around for a real long time, and people have done a lot of different things, and they've lived in a lot of different places in a lot of different ways. And the ethnographic record is not what percentage of all of human experience are you actually capturing with that?
Well, indeed. And I mean, a lot of our models come, as you are alluding to, from sort of ethnographic observations of actually a very small number of societies, right? So we've constructed this idea of band-level hunter-gatherers and then more centralized chiefdoms and then even more centralized states. And we have these analogies that are sort of ripped out of time and then sort of flung into the past. So we say, well, the people that painted Chove Cave, they must be like hunter-gatherers in the Kalahari. And the people that built Caballo Muerto must be like the chiefdoms of Polynesia that were observed in the 1700s by ethnographers and so on. That these models, we've really ripped things out of time and context. And it's not, in my view, not a very productive way. And there's all this work. You interviewed David Wengrow, this book, The Dawn of Everything, where it talks about all these different experiments and different kinds of social organization that people practicing all kinds of different economies exhibited through time and through space. And we should be more attuned to asking more nuanced questions than when we look in the further into the past about these societies that don't fit in with neo-evolutionary kinds of models, if that makes any sense.
It absolutely makes sense. And I mean, it's even when looking at more recent periods, it's really easy to flatten out the complexity of how societies actually worked. I've spent a lot of time on the Middle Ages over the years, but even if you're looking at, let's say, the later Middle Ages, where it seems fairly straightforward and hierarchical that you have kings and nobles and you got a small urban middle class, and then you've got a whole mass of peasants. Well, but peasants are differentiated. Peasants have their own ways of organizing themselves, their own ways of relating to various levels of power and authority above them. Nobles as a corporate group are not automatically subject to what the king wants to do. There's a lot of different competing factors that go into making that one society work on a day-to-day basis and over a longer period of time. It's not nascent absolutism. in that sense. And
exactly. And I think if you also add in with all of that, the sort of political dimensions, right, that of course people make decisions, right? So we can have some kind of abstracted vision of what the Middle Ages looks like. But of course, when we look at sort of the day-to-day or the politics of it, it's a more complicated thing. And in some ways, I think that's the problem with new evolutionary models, that calling something hierarchical doesn't really tell you very much. Or calling something decentralized doesn't tell you very much. You have to start to think about, okay, well, what kinds of organization, what kind of system are we looking at? And that requires a lot of work. And there's lots of data that we're missing for the initial period, for the early horizon, which I also work on, those kinds of things. We are missing a lot of sort of data to help us sort of flesh that out. So as
you're kind of looking forward here, I want to ask you, what is most exciting to you as you're thinking about your work, the work that your colleagues are doing, looking at the next decade or two in the Andes? I mean, what are the things that really strike you and draw your attention?
Well, as I said at the beginning, so I've been working sort of on this period from the late third millennium through to the middle first millennium BC. So I'll just start by saying that the amount of work that's being done on these time periods has increased. There are a lot of Peruvian scholars working on the late pre-ceramic period on the coast, for example, and other regions as well. That's really exciting to me. My own work has shifted into highland Peru, looking at sort of the initial period in the highlands, where we see sort of similar developments, but slight different in other ways to what we were talking about with the coast. And there's lots of interesting work that's being done in the highlands. I'm excited about that, mainly for personal reasons. At a broader level, like everywhere, the Andes is also going through some of the same kinds of scientific revolutions that are happening in other areas. So you had Christian Christensen on your show talking about advances in studies about mobility and migration using genetic and isotopic work. That's increased as well in the Andes. I've been collaborating with colleagues looking at Lars Fehrenschmitz and Eden Washburn at the University of California, Santa Cruz, are looking at sort of long-term subtle genetic changes in the northern highland, in an area, Highland Ancash, where we've looked at sort of changes in mobility and migration, and we've used DNA. We're using isotope analysis to look at mobility at different time periods. We're looking at carbon and nitrogen isotopes to reconstruct diet. And then my other colleagues, you know, from other institutions have been doing similar studies for different time periods. So that this sort of genetic revolution has also hit Andean archaeology. I'm also really excited. I do consider myself to have very broad interests within South American archaeology. At a broader level, I'm very excited by work done not just in the Andes, but in the Amazon region, which is a huge area of South America and a huge area of, say, just Peru is one example. But work in northeastern Peru, in Ecuador, in Brazil, and in eastern Bolivia, I'm very excited by a lot of the work that's being done on Amazonia, which is informing some of the things that we know are important for the time period that we've talked about today. So the movement of domesticates, there's been really interesting work in eastern Bolivia and adjacent regions of Brazil on this subject. There's been documentation of sites that are basically contemporary with the initial period, in some cases even earlier, in 2000 BC and earlier, in Ecuador and adjoining parts of Peru, but of the sort of eastern flanks of the Andes and upper Amazon. So I'm very excited by that work. And then denser settlements, monuments, there's all kinds of things that are showing up. And it just shows when once you start to look, you often find things that you either weren't expecting or were expecting something, but then you find something radically different. And I think all of that is extremely exciting and interesting.
It's a good reminder to always examine our priors.
Well, indeed, yeah. I mean, there were archaeologists that had long argued all the way back to sort of early Andean archaeology. The founder of Peruvian archaeology, Julio Ceteo, who is a very interesting archaeologist, a Quechua speaker, so one of the first indigenous archaeologists in the Americas, and one of the really early professional archaeologists of the Americas in general. And he long postulated that sort of the roots of complex societies were in so Chavin civilization and maybe things before had some connections to the Amazon region. And that these new findings are certainly bearing some of that out. So that's exciting. And then other scholars have also, that followed on Tao's work, Donald Lathrop and others, it seems that at least some of their ideas, not all of them, but some of their ideas are being borne out, probably in ways they wouldn't have been expecting, but are being borne out in interesting ways. So it's an intriguing area.
Oh, it's a really exciting time to be working on the archaeology of South America. Professor Nesbitt, thank you so much for your time. This was an absolutely fascinating conversation. Like I said, I could talk to you for hours about it.
Well, thank you. I can go all day too. Thank you very much. This was really great and fun. And I'm a big admirer of your show.
Oh, thank you so much. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. Thanks so much for joining me today. Be sure and hit me up if you'd like to chat about anything we've talked about on Tides or something you'd like to see. You can find me on Twitter at Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at Patrick Wyman MMA or on Instagram at Wyman_Patrick. I write on other topics at patrickwyman.substack.com. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe. From Wondery, the executive producers are Jenny Lower-Beckman and Marshall Louie. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.